I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE on Nicaragua Liberation Day, marking the victory of global South-backed Sandinista revolutionaries against CIA-backed death squads in Central America. This week, Nicaragua was just one of the nations at the Hague Group Summit in Bogota, Colombia, to condemn US-UK-EU armed genocide in Gaza. And like other nations of the global South, Nicaragua supports Russia in the US proxy war on Moscow through Ukraine. In Ukraine, Zelensky decreed another 90 days of unelected martial law. Donald Trump, for his part, has been busy covering up for Israeli spy Jeffrey Epstein, angering his MAGA base, this while pouring U.S. money to fund the Holocaust in Palestine and announcing threats against Russia. In China, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting met to engineer a new world. In the U.S. Capitol is someone who has been at Carnegie Endowment and the notorious RAND Research Organization, where Daniel Ellsberg once leaked documents to end the Vietnam War. Jennifer Kavanaugh is now a senior fellow and director of analysis at the Washington-based think tank Defense Priorities. Jennifer, thanks so much for coming on. There's a fair degree of chaos in this region, of course, since Trump launched airstrikes on Yemen, on Iran, and now his friend Israel. They've bombed the Syrian capital. It won condemnation from the United Arab Emirates, a country that Trump is fond of talking about and of making deals. The UAE strongly condemned the dangerous escalation in southern Syria, firmly denounced the Israeli airstrikes. But I want to talk to you about Ukraine, of course. Just a month ago at the Quincy Institute, you were recommending ending secondary-style sanctions on Russia and walking away. And then Trump on Monday, there's a lot of disinformation about this, of course. The Japanese Financial Times saying Trump urged Zelensky to strike into Russia and asked if Moscow could be hit. The Japanese FT, I think, had to apologize for that story. It was all nonsense. What did you make of the announcement from Trump about 50 days timelines and Western European nations buying weapons to target Russia?
Well, I thought the announcement was really a lot more show than substance. I mean, militarily, what the Europeans are able to provide from their stocks, even if they can backfill it from the United States or whatever they might purchase from U.S. stocks, is quite limited in quantity. U.S. and European stocks are already quite depleted of munitions. So any weapons that are going to arrive quickly will be limited in quantity and type. And if the Europeans are planning to buy new production, which is another option for them, that will take time to get to Ukraine. So it's not going to change the battlefield balance in any major way. It is a big change, though, for Trump politically, in that he's now long insisted that this was Biden's war, not his war. And now he's taken a step towards making it his war. So whereas I thought a month ago that he could walk away and cut U.S. involvement with no political consequences or fallout, now I think the risks are higher for him. And so he has sort of put himself in a tough position now, much harder for him to walk away from this conflict should things go bad without facing repercussions domestically.
Easier to comprehend his decision-making if he's getting the wrong intel. I mean, Colonel Tulsi Gabbard was down the end of the cabinet room table at that recent filmed cabinet meeting, pretty quiet. Where do you think he's getting the information that secondary sanctions would have any impact? I mean, does he know that the IMF said last year Russia was the fastest growing economy of advanced countries and that it has been destroying RTX Raytheon Patriot batteries on arrival? Do you believe he's getting the information from select John Ratcliffe at the CIA, Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, and not listening to other elements of the intelligence community that would clearly be warning him that sanctions have not been nearly as useful as was envisaged by those who were for the proxy war?
Well, Trump has always been skeptical of the U.S. intelligence community. That was true during his first term as well. He chooses to get his information from different sources. So it's hard to say exactly which voices are loudest in his ear right now. But he does have a love of tariffs, and he has a very high confidence, whether right or wrong, that tariffs are an effective way to achieve his policy aims. I tend to agree that, you know, putting tariffs on Russia certainly isn't going to affect its behavior vis-a-vis the United States, because the United States and Russia are not trading that much right now. And trying to put tariffs on Russian trading partners is really not a credible threat. You know, we're talking about potentially putting 100% tariffs on India, a really important U.S. security partner, on Europe, again, important U.S. security partner, or in China. We already tried that. Trump had put extensive tariffs, very high tariffs on China early in the term and had to back down because of the cost to the U.S. economy. So to me, this threat is really, really not credible, regardless of how Trump thinks it's going to turn out.
Unless he's trying to satisfy some leftover hawkish element from the genocide Joe Biden administration. I mean, clearly, this did not perturb Russia particularly. I don't know whether Trump even realized he was speaking the day before the Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting in Tianjin, where China then said Russia and China must, quote, strengthen mutual support.
Well, there are elements in the United States that have been very adamant that that support to Ukraine should continue and increase, and that penalties on Russia should get harsher. And that's the only way to achieve peace. And you see that coming from U.S. Congress, as well as from a parade of European diplomats who come to D.C. to sell that message. And they have obviously been persuasive to Trump in this moment. I think he liked the image of the strike, U.S. strike in Iran, felt that it projected U.S. strength, and I think he's hoping to repeat that here with this approach to Ukraine. I think he's also quite frustrated with what he feels is Putin's playing games with him in terms of they'll have talks and then Putin bombs Kiev. And I think that Trump doesn't like to be made a fool of. And I think there may be a little bit of his reaction here that is responding to that, wanting to show strength and not weakness.
Yeah, clearly my interview with you now is being recorded before any subsequent action by Israel against Iran. It has highly destabilized the region, arguably the Trump aerial bombardment of Tehran. But then you're at Defense Priorities. You appear at Quincy Institute events. We have a number of Quincy fellows on our show from time to time. What's the mood in think tank world in Washington, D.C. that what they say isn't really taken on board by elements of the Trump administration? It's all a waste of time. Or is there a growing opinion that is getting closer to your view of the Ukraine proxy war, very different to the view that was king during the Biden years?
Well, I'm not sure that Quincy and Defense Priorities are kind of conventional think tanks in the D.C. think tank space. So I think there's probably quite a lot of divergence between how various organizations in D.C. are reacting to recent events. And you can certainly see that play out. I think there is frustration among those of us who are really focused on trying to advocate for a more restrained U.S. foreign policy, that policy seems to be moving in the opposite direction.
That policy that was advocated by Trump during his presidential campaign.
Yes, I think it is frustrating because I think there was a lot of hope. I think that's why it's frustrating, is that there was hope that policy would shift in this more restrained direction, that Trump promised to be a peacemaker. He brought people into his administration that seemed to be aligned with that view, that wanted to pull back from Europe, that wanted to get out of Ukraine, that wanted to do less in the Middle East. And instead, all the opposite things seem to be happening and trending in that direction. So I think there is frustration. I don't think that anybody has given up hope. Because we see how quickly Trump reverses direction and changes his mind. Certainly there is plenty of time and space for that to happen. The administration is only about 6 or 7 months in now, although it feels like a lot longer. It's still quite new. So I think there's still a lot of time for a policy change to happen. But I do think there is some frustration among people who were supportive of Trump because they liked this foreign policy view about foreign policy views that he sold on the campaign trail.
How disturbed should Global South leaders be, let alone Vladimir Putin, be when Lindsey Graham seems to compare the Ukraine situation with the Iran situation and says, okay, Russia, you'll learn if you don't play ball, you'll get the same treatment as Ayatollah Khamenei. How disturbing is it? I mean, already what Trump said, arguably, is not the kind of thing said in 1962 during the Cuban Missile Crisis. These are nuclear powers.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see Lindsey Graham as someone who has a tremendous amount of influence with the administration right now, although he is often the mouthpiece of the more hawkish foreign policy views. I would note that that Trump hasn't gone along with what Lindsey Graham has proposed. I mean, Lindsey Graham was in favor of regime change in Iran and proposed 500% tariffs and sanctions, not 100%. So Trump hasn't gone with what Lindsey Graham and the most hawkish voices have suggested. So there is some moderation there. I also think that there is a recognition, especially among military community and military commanders who Trump trusts, that a limited strike operation might work with Iran, especially after its air defenses were degraded by Israeli military campaign. But like a limited strike, like bombing of Russia, is not really in the cards. Like that's not a feasible plan. Trump likes these big, showy, in and out military operations. We saw that during the first term with the assassination of Qasem Soleimani and in other instances. But that is a limited tool that works against certain adversaries. It doesn't work against Russia. It doesn't work against China. But I do think that there should be some concern about how the current administration is thinking about escalation threats and escalation risks. They are significant. The Biden administration also was quite careless in my view, but seemed to have sort of a greater recognition of comments about Zelensky firing missiles at Moscow, whether they're true or not. That those are the types of things that can cause miscalculation and unintended escalation. So I do think it's something the administration should be concerned about and thinking about more carefully.
Yeah, he, of course, denied saying anything that was reported in the FT like that. But then is there no understanding in the Trump administration, in the Beltway, in the think tanks, that from this region, as far as the Trump's unprovoked attacks on Iran, what they've heralded is a growing understanding in the Global South that nuclear weapons are what a country needs to retain its sovereignty. We had a former IMF director on this show ahead of the BRICS summit in Rio saying Brazil, Iran, all these countries clearly are now thinking nuclear weapons programs are essential. That is basically the effect of Trump's attack on Iran. No understanding of that in the administration?
It's certainly not the message that they're sending. I mean, the message that they're sending is that this was a strong signal that nuclear proliferation is off limits and that the United States will intervene. But I agree with you that the message is exactly the opposite to any Global South or other country looking at this situation, is that nuclear weapons are the only way to be secure. And I do think that it will lead to more nuclear proliferation, which is ironic, because the goal here was to prevent proliferation, and the result ultimately, in my view, will be the opposite.
Jennifer Kavanagh, I'll stop you there. More from the Senior Fellow and Director of Analysis at Defense Priorities after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the Senior Fellow and Director of Analysis at Defense Priorities, Jennifer Kavanagh. Jennifer, we were talking about a new era of nuclear weapons proliferation. Who knows, because of Trump's antics in Iran. But clear that for Vladimir Putin, he's lost a measure of deterrence with the Western European NATO members. Because the fact that, I know that France and Italy immediately expressed a desire not to take up Trump's offer, and they won't be buying any Raytheon Patriot batteries. Germany wants to. And Britain, I think at the time of this recording, hasn't said anything. But because of Putin's behavior, lots of these Western European countries feel pretty much free to have people navigating these missiles from in situ in Ukraine, and new batteries and missiles being exported. And they don't expect to be hit themselves because of the fact that Vladimir Putin has never threatened the countries that are supplying these weapons and engineering them.
Well, I think Putin has been quite careful since the beginning of the war not to let this expand into a Russia-NATO war. There's some talk that that's what it is in actuality, because it's NATO countries arming Ukraine, and because some of the security concerns that motivated the conflict in the first place had to do with Ukraine security alignment and NATO expansion. But I think that since the beginning, it's been clear that he has tried to avoid taking steps that would force NATO to respond in a more significant way. And that's included allowing the missiles and other weapons to transit across the Polish border, It's included, I think, making sure that Russian missiles didn't land by accident in NATO countries, and, you know, limited harassment of U.S. and other countries' aircraft in surrounding airspace. I think there was an unmanned drone that, you know, ended up becoming a casualty of this, but that is easier to avoid escalation when you have just autonomous capabilities. So I guess I see it as less a loss of deterrence and more a strategic choice that this to make this about Ukraine and not not a wider regional war.
Yeah, so far that's worked as regards the Russian public, according to all the surveys. But, you know, only this week, attacks on Voronezh, other Russian cities. Does it surprise you, who have been analyzing these things, how hawkish Chancellor Merz is, Keir Starmer, and let alone Rutte and the rest of them? They want to pump ever more weapons, ballistic weaponry, to target Moscow, literally. And yet there are no apparent red lines for Vladimir Putin.
Well, the European strategy, I think, is a little bit of smoke and mirrors here. They claim that this is an existential war. This is an existential threat for European security, that Ukraine must be victorious. And they're really putting pressure on the United States to spend more and send more military aid. But they don't act like it's an existential war. If this were really an existential threat, you would expect to have seen Europe really investing in its defense industrial base since 2022, and you haven't seen that. You've seen this 5% commitment that was made at the NATO summit, but that commitment it doesn't come due for 10 years. So this doesn't suggest any sort of urgency. There's a lot of hawkish talk, but not a lot of action here. So I guess I see the European hawkishness here less about targeting Moscow and more about tying the U.S. into Europe. And there is a real fear in Europe that the United States under Trump will abandon them, that it will pull U.S. forces out, that it will, you know, pull out of NATO. And that will mean that then they'd be on the hook for their own security. And it's less about their fear of Russia attacking them and more about the economic consequences that would come from having to pay for their own military force for the first time in like 80 years or so. And so to me, a lot of the talk about what is required in Ukraine and how dire the situation is more about trying to get the U.S. To take it seriously, to tie the U.S. into Europe. And they achieved that a little bit this week with Trump's announcement, because now he is tied politically to the war in a way that he wasn't before.
Although not by giving away U.S. public money in the form of weapons to Zelensky, in fairness. And of course, no further announcements about any idea of troop withdrawals from the big bases like Ramstein and all the myriad bases in Britain, for instance. Again, for Russia's part, do you believe there's less impetus for negotiations with the United States from any country, actually, given that Trump was in negotiations with Iran when he bombed it? Very few people trust the United States anymore. So the status ante, the status post, might as well just keep things going, is the views of the BRICS nations, without having to come to any signed accords of any kind, which anyway might be reneged on by a Trump administration.
Yeah, you know, that was actually my first thought when the Israeli military campaign started, was that it would have negative effects on the ability to get to a peace settlement in between Russia and Ukraine, because the United States had been planning for talks supposedly on that Saturday right before the strike started. So, you know, number one, why negotiate with the United States if they're going to hold diplomacy out as a carrot and then attack militarily anyway? And number two, because Steve Witkoff had played such an important role in both of these negotiations, it kind of undermined his credibility. Well, you know, what influence does he have if no settlement is reached? So I do see, and then to make matters worse, Trump sort of did it again, playing with diplomacy a week later, before actually getting the U.S. directly involved. So I do think that that has hurt U.S. credibility when it comes to negotiations. And I can understand why any other world leader would be hesitant to engage in negotiations with the United States without real assurances that those negotiations were going to prevent the military punishments or economic threats that Trump had put on the table. And in this case with Russia, I don't see the assurances as being there.
Every day, of course, in this region, we see the effects of the genocide. It's being reported every day in GCC countries, across the Arab world. In Washington, the way Trump repeatedly talks about the B-2 bombers hitting the Fordo nuclear facility, is there any idea in D.C. in the Trump administration that Russia and China have all week been sending cargo planes, perhaps of weapons, to Iran this week? And the fact that, say, MBS has been very clear attacking the genocide of Israel. As I said, the UAE this week condemned Israeli aggression in Syria. Any realization that there's a certain precariousness of all these myriad U.S. bases in the Middle East as he leaves it up to Netanyahu to unilaterally act? I think he bombed four capitals in 6 weeks, Sana'a, Beirut, Tehran, and Damascus.
I mean, certainly among me and my colleagues, there is a lot of concern about the safety of U.S. personnel in the region. And we've argued multiple times in multiple different venues that that these personnel should be withdrawn, especially the most vulnerable in Iraq and Syria, but also the other bases. You know, my view is that the United States does not really have extensive security or even economic interests in the United States that are advanced by having 40,000 U.S. forces in the region. Instead, the effect is that anything that happens in the region pulls the United States in. And there aren't many countries in the region who are excited to see the U.S. military show up for good reason after repeated failures and making bigger messes than when they arrived. So, you know, I do think that the U.S. military presence is a liability, does not advance U.S. interests, and certainly should be downsized. You know, how widespread that is, I can't say. I think it's a growing belief, but the policymakers making the decisions still believe that this is that these bases are important for protecting U.S. power, for maintaining stability, and this overall narrative that, you know, world stability requires global U.S. military presence. Now, I don't believe that, and there's not a lot of evidence to support it, but it's still the driving narrative behind a lot of decisions that are made around U.S. foreign policy. That said, there is concern about the cooperation between Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea, but not that much that U.S. policymakers can do to stop it, as instead, you know, it's really the opposite. The policies that U.S. puts in place drives these countries together and exacerbates and encourages that cooperation.
Clearly, the working classes that are the MAGA base who service all these myriad U.S. bases will be the first to say we'd love to come home. But then on the other hand, maybe John Ratcliffe at the CIA and Rubio is telling Trump we can always evacuate before any attack, as they did so successfully at the Al Udeid base in Qatar, albeit now we have pictures that Iran actually did destroy some crucial radar material. We got pictures of that this week. Presumably Trump can just be told, no, we can always evacuate and save all the troops. None of them will die.
Well, then why have them there? You know, if that's the plan, to evacuate them when a crisis happens, why have them there? There are a lot, you know, I think that the a really important observation is that even when the United States decided it was going to strike Iran, it did not use the bases in the Middle East to do so. The assets that were valuable for this operation came from far away. So the forces there are a liability. They have to be evacuated in a crisis. They're not actually advancing any U.S. interests. They're just there. So I think actually your point increases the strength of my argument that that the best move is to pull them out. I mean, it's really just inertia. I think the biggest obstacle that those of us who are advocating for more restrained U.S. policy face is the status quo. It's hard to change. There's a lot of stakeholders who want to keep those bases, who want to keep the money flowing to the defense contractors. You know, a lot of generals who want the four stars to command these big military operations. So that's who you're fighting against, is the status quo and the way things have been for so long, even though now we're in a much radically different world than we were in you know, at the end of the Cold War during periods of U.S. primacy.
Yeah, a lot of money to be made, clearly. Well, just finally, what about the Western European economies that are showing such strain and stress, not only because of the proxy war through Ukraine, at home, their own populations oppose their arming of Israel, and indeed in Britain, where I'm from, freedom of speech under threat. Do you think Western Europe is showing greater signs of instability? I know that the media there, they don't really talk about Ukraine in any arguably sensible way. I mean, they didn't even report the Donetsk lithium mine that Trump was talking about was just taken by the Russians in the past few days.
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of strains, economic and otherwise. I think the economic strains, you know, as a military analyst, when I look at the economic strains, what I think about is how they're going to meet their commitments to arm themselves. How are they really going to spend 5% of GDP on military equipment, given the other economic challenges they face? I don't believe they will. So I see that 5% commitment as quite an empty one. And so, you know, that's kind of how I view that. I think there's a lot of angst and instability that's been stirred up as a result of the Ukraine war. And I think, you know, the Donetsk lithium mine that wasn't reported, again, this is just evidence that this crisis and conflict in Ukraine is not as important to Western Europe or the United States as some of the more hawkish voices suggest that it is.
Jennifer Kavanagh, thank you. And that's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those suffering the impact of the US-UK-EU armed bombing of Gaza, Yemen, Syria, Lebanon, and Iran. We'll be back on Monday with an ex-Israeli intelligence official who worked on behalf of the IDF. Until then, you can keep in touch via all our social media. If it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.